leadership, senior executive career management, mm-hmm. and corporate governance. He's a frequent contributor to the Harvard Business Review. He's quoted in the Wall Street Journal on occasion. And he's also the co-founder and CEO of a company called Stibel Peabody, which he formed with Marianne Peabody. Mm-hmm. And they specialize in executive coaching, leadership development, succession planning. They do retained search and outplacement. It's a very successful company, and I think one of the things that I was most impressed to read on your website is you've got, I think it's, if I get it right, it's 21% of the top 100 best places to work by Fortune magazine. I think that's a great compliment to your organization and your success. Larry is, he is also, in terms of credentials, he is a licensed psychologist, and he holds a doctorate from Harvard University.
Great. Thank you, Jack. When I was young and stupid, I thought learning was really tough. Now I'm officially old and stupid, and I can say without question, learning is actually pretty easy. It's unlearning the things that I learned that is really tough. And so tonight I want to talk about some things you might want to consider unlearning. Because unlearning is difficult because it helped you be successful up to this point in your careers. Will that same pattern be successful from here on? That's what we're going to be talking about. And the way I'm going to talk about it is through the life of Gorham Brigham. How many of you had ever had a personal meeting with Gorham Brigham? Raise your hands. Okay, so a number of you have. The one thing that I know for sure is every year, if I give this talk every year, the number of people that will raise their hands will get smaller and smaller until there won't be any hands raised. So I want to spend this evening talking about your career, but using Gorham Brigham's life as a metaphor that you might want to consider. I've written a tribute to Gorham that has been published in Psychology Today. If any of you would like a copy of this, just give me your business cards. I'm also taping this conversation, and if any of you would like to have a copy of this tape, just give me your business cards and I'll be glad to give it to you as well. After this talk, I hope to have a much more informal question and answer session about your careers and answer any questions that I can help you with. Gorham Brigham died at age 101 in September. For those of you who never met Gorham, here's the best way to describe him. If I call Central Casting and I said, give me a Boston Brahmin, they would send me Gorham Brigham. Even the name fit. F. Gorham Brigham Jr. How do you beat that? And he looked like a Boston Brahmin too, sort of blandly attractive in an Episcopalian sense, very conservative, conservatively dressed. If you've went to his home, absolutely not ostentatious at all. The best way to understand Gorham Brigham, and I'm not making a political statement, is think about Donald Trump, and then Gorham Brigham is the anti-Donald Trump. Anything Donald Trump would do, Gorham would probably be doing the opposite. So he would be soft-spoken. He would not be talking about himself, he'd be talking about you. That's the best way to think about Gorham Brigham. When he died, I thought, this guy, we've lost somebody special, but we also lost somebody who was a really 19th century gentleman. And they don't make them anymore. And boy, we lost something. I've now come to conclude, if you're going to be successful, you want to start looking at Gorham Brigham as a model for success in the 21st century. That instead of looking at him as a 19th century figure, I see Gorham as much more a 21st century figure. And let me give you some lessons that I learned from Gorham as I think about his life. The first is, at age 68, he was told, you're no longer needed here at the Boston Safe Deposit, and besides, you're 68, and I'm sure you'll want to retire. And so Gorham smiled and went across the street to the Boston 5-cent savings. And he stayed there from age 69 until age 90. He retired when he wanted to retire as senior vice president of Citizens Bank. Citizens Bank had purchased Boston 5 Cent Savings. He then taught a seminar, probably at FEI, called What Happens When if Your Company Retires You Before You're Ready to Retire. And the lesson that Gorham teaches is you decide when you're going to retire. The company doesn't have that right. One of the lessons to unlearn or to learn is there are certain four-letter words that you just don't use in mixed company. And one of those four-letter words, I know it's not four letters, but it's close enough, is retirement. Don't use the R word until you're ready to use the R word. The problem when you, once you utter the word retirement or semi-retired, you're also saying, I'm not in the game. And if you're retired for 2 years or more, you're out of the game forever. You can't come back in. And so Gorham never used the R word. I don't care if you are a consultant and have no clients. Don't use the R word. I think a good example of that would be Alan Faber, who is a member of FEI, and many of you know. I think Al's got to be his mid-80s. And he's still chugging along. At some point, you may want to retire, but do it on your terms when you want to, not when the company says. This is important. The reason why this is important is that many of you have a model of your heads about what's going to happen in your lives that is simply wrong. And the model of your heads comes from what happened to your parents. And for many of your parents, they may have retired at 62, 65, and died when they were 70, 75. I know when I was young, somebody who was 65 years old was a member of the Golden Age Club, and they would be playing Mahjong, and they were really old. Today, somebody who's 65 can't wait till it snows so they can go out to New Hampshire and go skiing. We're dealing with two really fundamental changes in society, and you are the first people to have to deal with this. The first is elongation of middle age. 65 doesn't mean you're old. It means the beginning, maybe, of the elder, but you're not nowhere in the old category. To put this in some sort of perspective, in a very dramatic way, when the Social Security system was created, I think in 1930, 1931, whenever it was, the mission of Social Security was to help the old, the frail elderly. That was the mission of the Social Security system. You could begin starting collecting benefits at age 65. The average of age of death was, anybody know what the average age of death was? It
was
64. So it was really for the elderly. That is not true anymore. If you want something, if you want to, you know, I tell all my clients, go to the Social Security Administration and look at mortality tables, look up your age, and look up the expectation for how long you have to live, and plan accordingly. The second thing is we have an elongation of middle age. You're not only going to live longer, but you're going to be relatively healthier. Sure, you're going to have more aches and pains, but you're not going to be an invalid in your 70s or even 75. What does that mean? The other thing that is important that makes this group relatively unique, you have elongation of middle age, longer life, and shorter job tenure. Many of you had a model of your careers that you would have long tenures in one company, 20, 25 years, 30 years, you get a gold watch, you go off to retire, just like maybe your parents did. But of course, that's not the way the world works anymore. Many of you are going to be going into short job tenures where you're going to be going into companies, you hope 3 years, 4 years, but it could be 2 years. That's just the way the world is. And what, so think about the economic implications of elongation of middle age and short job tenure, when it may take a year before you can invest in your retirement program. You add up that over a period of years, you may be 65 and you may not be able to afford to retire if you assume you will be living until age of 90. So you've got to start thinking about your career in different ways and stop using the R word. Gorham is a model that you may want to look at. He worked until age 90. Any questions about that? The other thing about Gorham, if you knew him when he was a banker, he loved the work he did. He was very work-driven, but he also enjoyed the work he did. And one of the things, and Bob and I were talking about this today, the worst thing you can possibly do in your career is to take a job that you do not like simply because you think it's going to be a cash out. So then once the cash out comes, you can then do the work you really want to do. As Warren Buffett once said, that is as smart as saving up sex for your old age. Enjoy the work that you're doing now and take the job because you enjoy it, but don't take the job because you think you're going to get some sort of life-changing event in the event of an IPO, and then you can do what you always wanted to do. The odds may be there, but they're against you. Any questions? Another thing about Gorham is Gorham was an extraordinarily conscientious person. Jack said I was a psychologist, so there's something called the Big Five personality factors, and one of the key personality factors is conscientiousness. Anybody who knew Gorham knew that he was an extraordinarily conscientious person. And what that means is, if you are a conscientious person, you need to have something you're conscientious about. Something that you really believe in and that's important to you. The people that I know who retire and really, really enjoy doing nothing all day, or they watch a lot of TV, or they walk their dogs and they're just really happy in retirement, often they weren't very conscientious to begin with. And so retirement really fits the pattern. If, on the other hand, you are a very conscientious person, and most people in FEI tend to be on the high side of conscientiousness, then you always need to have something to be conscientious about. Certainly Gorham was that way for as long as he physically was able to be that way. What are you going to be conscientious about? What's going to be a passionate, what's important to you? Lesson three. Robert Mahoney was the president of Citizens Bank, just acquired this Boston 5-cent savings bank. He goes to Gorham and says, what do you do? And Gorham says, I connect people. That's what he did. He connected people. Notice he didn't say, I'm a commercial lending officer. He said, I connected people. I know Citizens. It's a client of mine. There is no job description called connecting people. Gorham made up a job, and then he proceeded to do the job that he made up. And then Citizens thought it so valuable, they allowed him to continue to do it until he decided to retire at age 90. Here is a misconception that a lot of my clients have. When they think they're in transition, they think they're in a job search. And they use words like, I'm in the hunt for a job. Those words imply that there's something out there, like you're in the jungle looking for this prey, and you're looking for it. That gives you the hunter mentality. That's not what Gorham was doing. He was a creator. He created the job that didn't exist until Gorham defined it. He created the job. You can either be a hunter, you can be a farmer who actually plants the seeds and creates, or as I tell my clients, you do both. Let me give you an example of what I mean by creating a job. I had a client who was vice president of human resources, but in her earlier career, she had been a quality control person coming up through the manufacturing ranks. Not an unusual situation. So we have a database that our clients use called Hoover's, 18 million companies. We identified a really specific target list of manufacturing companies between 25 million and 75 million that were within 15 miles of her home. We identified the CEOs of each of these companies, and we wrote a letter saying, as you think about your talent needs, you might be interested in the fact that I can do both HR and quality. We identified 200 companies that were like that. We sent out 200 letters. Of the 200 letters, she only got one response back. And that was the CEO who said, "It's amazing to get your letter. What a coincidence. I've got two jobs that I need to fill, one VP of HR and one VP of quality, and I don't have the budget for both. But what I can do, because of you, I can create a new job called VP of quality and HR. And you're the only one that qualifies for this job." That's when you're creating a job that didn't exist until your letter arrived. And so the thing to unlearn is that if you're in transition, that you're in a job, quote unquote, search. Yes, but you are also in the job creation business. We're big believers in targeted direct mail. You may want to consider that. Don't wait. If you wait for the job to appear on your computer screen, I don't think that you're doing the right thing in a job search. Lesson number four. Here's a Gorham Brigham story, and everybody who knew Gorham Brigham has probably a very similar story. You know, you are a very important person. You're very special. Is that familiar? Is that Gorham?
Yeah.
Okay. I remember sitting with someone, and Gorham sees me in the restaurant, and he goes over to this other person and says, "You're in good hands with Larry." He has no idea who you are, but he knew who I was, and that's all he said. Notice, he's not talking about himself. He's talking about you. He's always, it's about you. It's not about him. How many of you, when you were children, watched Mr. Rogers? Okay. What was Mr. Rogers' famous song?
"Would You Be My Friend?"
Yeah, you are special. Always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. You are special. And Mr. Rogers could convey that to a child in such a way that the child actually did feel special. Gorham had that ability too. He could say, you're really very good, in a way that really made the other person feel special. That was a very unique gift that Gorham has. And it's a gift that we need to cultivate. Networking really is about searching for that specialness in that other person and letting them know that you understand that they are special. We all want to feel special. We all have a desperate need to feel special. And the person, whether it's Mr. Rogers or Gorham Brigham or you, who acknowledges, you really are unique, you unlock the key to their hearts. Gorham was successful not because he sold. I seriously doubt that Gorham ever sold anything. But he got people to do things because they wanted to. The other thing that Gorham would do, how many of you have ever got a note from Gorham? Okay. Was it typewritten or was it email?
Handwritten
on nice, heavy stock. that reinforces you're special. I took the time to handwrite this on a nice quality paper, lick a stamp, and send it to you. Mm-hmm. Think about it. Is anybody excited about getting an email? But a nice handwritten, how many handwritten notes do you get these days? Now, in 1984, John Nesbitt wrote a book called About the Future. And John Nesbitt in this book talked about something called high tech, high touch. And what he said was this paradox. As society becomes more technologically sophisticated, the value of high touch becomes even more important. Gorham may or may not have understood this, but he acted in a way that was consistent. He always made you feel special. He always gave you a special note, handwritten, reaffirming that you were special. And again, that's totally consistent with John Nesbitt's book. If you really want to stand out, don't send an email. If you really want to stand out, go to a nice card shop, get nice thank you letters, and write something in hand. If you really want to stand out and get to somebody's heart, come to a meeting like this and don't focus on what you can get out of it. Focus on what you can do for somebody else. Gorham always assumed that in the end, what goes around comes around, and I think he was right. Any questions about that? This is so important because one of the problems with mobile devices is it begins to change the neural patterns in our brains. And as we continue to use mobile devices, and as we get into these little enclaves where we're surrounded by people who just think like us, and we get our news from news vendors who just look at the world the same way we do, we begin to lose empathy for other people. And there's been some studies that talk about people who are very heavy into mobiles really, really lack empathy. And Gorham was not like that at all. So I think, again, if you come across as somebody who is empathic, who really tries to relate to other people, who really tries to look at the other person's perspective, that's not just a nice thing to do. It's a nice way to, it's going to be an important differentiating point. I see this with young people. They are so focused. They've created this technology world around them where they're only talking to their friends. They're only dealing with the people that they look at the way the world works, and then they look at everybody else as weird. Empathy is a challenge. Any questions? So again, the lesson is focus on the other person. Treat them as special. If you want to communicate and it's important and you want to differentiate, go get a nice thank you card and write by longhand. Lesson 5, build something that's going to remain after you're gone. Gorham was a master at this. Gorham was on a hospital board. He was on the Carroll School for the Blind. He founded the Treasurer's Club. He was very, very active in FEI. And indeed, FEI has the F. Gorham Brigham Jr. Award for Lifetime Achievement that it has every year. He was very big into building communities. So it was never about him. It was about building something that would outlast him. And certainly FEI, he's helped build FEI. And that's something that you may want to do too. Again, it's a way of thinking about your professional life, not just your job search, but your professional life. Any questions? So to summarize, 1, find work that mixes business and pleasure so that you're no longer working. Be aware of Warren Buffett saying, the person who's doing something they dislike now so they can do something they like later is like saving up sex for old age. It doesn't work. If you can't find the job title that's a fit, then go create the job. Too many of the candidates we work with are in a job search mode as opposed to a job creation mode. You want to be both a hunter and a gardener at the same time. Next, your former employer does not decide when you retire. That decision belongs to you. Next, high tech, high touch. As society becomes more technologically sophisticated, then the value of high touch becomes more important. If you want people to help you, treat them as though they were special. Again, I wrote this tribute to Gorham in Psychology Today. If any of you would like a copy of the Psychology Today article, just give me your business cards. So that concludes the formal presentation part. So what I'd like to do is, I'm in the career business. I help people with their careers. Any questions that any of you might have that we can have just a conversation? Anything? Yep.
Someone who never met Gorham, where do you think it came from?
Gorham?
Yeah. His behavior, demeanor, where did that come from?
I don't know. You guys knew Gorham better than me. Where do you think?
Well, I a lot of it, I think, is just he was just such a genuinely good guy. I've never seen a more selfless human being in my life than Gorham. He was always concerned about how could he best help others achieve whatever it is that they were looking to achieve, and that could take on any number of things. I think he was just innately selfless, and the guy also was blessed with an unbelievable memory. And so he could put people together in a way that I've never seen anybody even come close to. If you had an issue, his recall was, and this was until, what, Peter, within the last year of his life? Yeah, this was north of 100. He still had, you'd walk into either his house or in the last several months of his life, you'd walk into the room in his nursing home, and he'd immediately either start peppering you about the go-dos that he told you needed to go do before, or he'd say, hey, listen, I had a conversation with so-and-so. I think if we put them in touch with this person, that might make a lot of sense, don't you think? And you'd say, yeah, Gorham, that's unbelievable. And the way he could connect the dots, so I'd say it was his innate selflessness and his sheer capacity for remembering kind of people, places, and things and connecting the dots. I mean, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, partly what you didn't talk about too is his work ethic. He had an unbelievable drive and energy to continue working well into his 90s. But he shared with me a story when he was Army ROTC, was a lieutenant colonel in his final rank. But he was in the reserves, and in this particular phase of his life, he had young children, and his boss came to him and said, Gorham, you know, you're taking your vacation time to do this ROTC stuff. I think you should take vacation and, you know, just enjoy it. And he goes, and apparently he had a 10-year period where he didn't do anything beyond work and ROTC, and but he just was driven. And like I said, he was well-educated, he was well-spoken, he was well-mannered. He wanted, I think, that to be his legacy, to help train other people how to behave well and how to interact well with others. And, and hopefully he sprinkled that around the room, and we'll carry that forward.
Well, probably one of the most emblematic examples that immediately comes to my mind, and there were a lot of them. Peter and I actually were invited to have lunch with Gorham. This is probably about 4 years ago at the Country Club. And he was a lifelong member of the Country Club in Brookline. And so Peter and I met Gorham for lunch one day. Happened to be a day when his daughter, who lives up in New Hampshire, was down with a group of women that she had known for years. And they were upstairs in a private room having some kind of a woman's gathering. One of the husbands of one of the women that came down was sitting two tables away from us in the dining room, kind of left to his own devices. Well, this troubled Gorham so terribly. He wanted this guy to feel as though he were welcome and included. And he not only went over and had a personal conversation, he summoned half the dining room staff to make sure that this fellow was not feeling all alone just because he happened to be seated by himself to have some lunch. But I mean, that was the kind of guy that Gorham was. And so, like Larry said, he carried this through everything he did. And I think if all of us could, you know, kind of carry ourselves in some form or fashion like that, he made himself very memorable, and he made himself, you couldn't help but admire the way the guy carried himself.
And there was one more thing. I could never give him anything without it somehow coming back to me. It was uncanny. He was always looking across the table, asking, what can I do for you?
My Gorham Brigham story was, one of my heroes in history is George C. Marshall, the founder of the Marshall Plan and general of the Army, general during the World War II. And Gorham knew about this, and he called me to let me know that he had been chief of staff to General George Marshall during World War II. I go, really? Can we meet? And so we met, and he talked about George C. Marshall and what it was like. And then he reviewed a book for me that we put on our website about George C. Marshall. But one of the things that you need to understand is that he was involved in the middle of World War II, which was kind of an issue of, will we survive as a nation? And he was working with a man who was putting thousands and thousands of Americans at risk, knowing that some or a great percentage of them were going to die. And so he was in the middle of these high stakes, high drama situations. You just don't have time to be selfish. And what he found was, I think George C. Marshall sort of was a role model for him. And I think one of the things that he said about George C. Marshall was that he always addressed people in a formal way, and there was a formal quality about George C. Marshall, because he never wanted to get that close to people who he might be putting to death. And there was this friendliness about Gorham, but there was also a reserve about Gorham at the same time. Any other questions? Either about Gorham or your careers?
Yes, this is more granular and,
sure,
and tactical in nature.
Yeah, sure, that's fine.
Recently, being someone who's left my position, how quickly, when you embark on your search, would you recommend that you're updating your profile,
right,
your resume, your other paper trail, that you've left your company? Because there's a certain gray area when you've recently left that could be beneficial, but what is your recommendation in terms of, you know, how to do that, and, you know, when to update things?
How long is your salary continuation? When does your salary continuation stop?
It's 6 months.
So as long as you are, again, when some people leave, they get a lump sum severance,
yeah,
and some people get a salary continuation.
Yeah.
So as long as you are on salary, you can certainly say on your resume and your LinkedIn profile that you're still employed.
Okay.
Your job is to,
yeah,
find a new job.
Yeah.
Period. Once the salary continuation period is over, it gets a little sketchy.
Yeah. Okay. I like that.
All right. Sir.
I was intrigued by the title of this speech. Mm-hmm. What was going to be the title, I guess. Three things to unlearn.
Yep.
And that may be implicit in what you told us here.
Yeah.
But could you just kind of list the three?
I think one of the things to unlearn is the concept of retirement as, okay, I'm going to be 62, 64, 65, and then I'm going to be able to just kind of do anything I want until I die. I think we need to unlearn that. For many of the people in this room, that is not the way it's going to happen. You will be working longer than you think you're going to be working, and you might as well be enjoying the work you're doing. Many of you, a second thing to unlearn is when I was young, there were and I would go to FEI meetings, there were people like me who were consultants, like you're a consultant. And Al is with a consulting firm. And then there were people who worked, and they were W-2 people. And we existed just fine, but they were separate tracks. And I saw so many of my clients when they were looking for jobs, they would be saying, I'm really looking for a full-time job. I'm not a consulting job. And so they would look at consulting as kind of a second tier and a kind of a demeaning role. The problem is that we're now entering a period of time when this is the relationship. Whereas it used to be like this, it's now like this. And you're going to be going in and out of 1099 to W-2s to 1099s. I tell my clients, don't use the J word, the job. I'm looking for a job. Don't say that. Say, I'm looking for an assignment. Could be full-time, could be part-time, could be 1099. I'm looking for an assignment where I can add value. That gives you the flexibility. Many of my clients, they do not go from W-2 job to W-2 job. They go from W-2 to 1099, from 1099 to W-2, and then W-2 to 1099. So need to unlearn the issues about the best jobs are W-2 jobs. And consulting jobs from now, no. Everybody in this room, you may have had your career as an employee, but you will end your career as a consultant. And you will end your career later than you think you're going to end it. And that's something to unlearn.
Larry, in that transition of W-2 to 1099 and back and forth, how many people would you say, broadly, start off with a small little bit of an assignment? As a 1099 consultant, which morphs into saying, you know, this guy's great, we love him, and let's create a job around him.
Absolutely. That's increasingly common. And one of the things that I'm seeing in the economy is I'm looking for a slowdown. I think after the election, Janet Yellen will increase the interest rates. I expect the stock market to slow down after November. I expect the problems in China to continue. The problems in Europe will continue. And so my clients are really concerned about the future, and they're very reluctant to make hiring decisions. So they're more likely to bring in a consultant to deal with the problems right now, and then let's worry about later and see where things are. So people don't want to make that many commitments. That's what I'm seeing.
If I can just make a quick point, I've known a lot of CFOs and controllers who valued the W-2 track, and yet they found themselves being hired to solve a particular problem. When that problem was over, very often those companies were looking for a different person to take that company to the next level. And in those particular cases, I've advised a few people that they should look at themselves as consultants, even if they're FTEs. And it kind of helps them look at their job a little bit differently, a little bit more dispassionately, and it doesn't mean they work any less hard at any of it, but they're not so emotionally crushed when somebody comes in and says, you're not the guy for the next, you're not the guy to take us from 400 million to 800 million.
Yeah.
Or from 800 million down to 400 million, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
They're too expensive for that.
And I think another model I think that we all need to unlearn is the whole idea of careers as ladder climbing. And a career is defined as a series of upward progressions within one organization. And a good career is like climbing the ladder of success. Even the very framework of the words used are harmful, because that's not the way the world works in a period of short job tenure and constantly swapping. You know, you're good for growth and you're good for decline, and people are, that's just the way things are. The model that I use is you are a skier and you're skiing through different kinds of snow, and sometimes it's nice packed powder and sometimes it's ice, and you have to be able to maneuver on these different terrains. It's not about single ladder climbing up one to as long as you have that model in your mind. And some of you may be in between jobs and you still have that model in your mind. As long as you have that model in your mind, you will fail, because the world doesn't work that way anymore. Okay. Any other questions? Yep.
I love your comment about making people feel special and, you know, that they're unique. When you're figuring out where you want to target and you've created your job that you know where it is and you want to talk to this person, how do you convey that you are special and you are unique in that letter or whatever?
I think in the...
To be short. Can't keep going on and
moving on. It's relatively formulaic. First of all, you need a good database. We use Hoover's, but there are others. But any database that would allow you to do SIC or industry code. The second is sales volume. And the second is distance from your home. So the database we use would say, I'm in 01778. I want to work for companies that are within 20 miles of that.
But I know where I want to go. I'm saying, how do I make that individual I want to hire me to know what I'm saying is you're unique and you are special? How do I say that through?
Let's say you identify 200 companies that are in that list. It really involves going to the websites of those 200 companies and going to usually they have a news section, and finding out what they are saying about themselves and what they're proud of right now, and saying, I was inspired to look at your website and understand about the new XYZ product that's come out, congratulations. Or heard about the new sale that you made to the Pentagon, congratulations. You start out with, this letter is not about me, but about you. One of the things I tell my clients, and I would suggest that you do, every time you write a letter regarding your job search, count the number of times you use the word I, and try to reduce them. Because every time you use the word I, you are sending a message, this letter is about me. You are the seller in a capitalist economy that is dominated and controlled by the buyers. That's simply the way it is. The reader of the letter truly and sincerely doesn't care about you. They are concerned about their problems, and the more you can focus on their issues, the better. So instead of using the word I, use the word you. I looked at your website and was very impressed. As you look at the attached resume, you may see that some of my skills in this might be of value to your team. In other words, I'm here to help you. I'm not here to talk about myself. This is Sales 101. But even great salespeople, when they're trying to market themselves, forget that. Yes, sir.
So you brought up two things which were very interesting. You talked about high tech, and you talked about, you know, the 19th century gentleman.
Yep.
And you try to put those together with the millennials coming up, and, you know,
yep,
like teenagers.
Yep.
They're about as far away from 19th century gentleman as I can. The gentleman, but, you know, the way they dress,
yeah,
acting, writing,
right,
notes and all that. How do you, knowing that this big millennial bubble is coming up,
yep,
and there's still a big baby boom / Gen X bubble that wants to work until,
yep,
90, how do we put these together? Because they're the ones oftentimes that are making the buying decisions, i.e. hiring decisions, as they come up the ladder to a certain degree.
Again, look at this as marketing 101. And marketing 101 is about product differentiation. You know, none of those millennials are ever going to go home to their spouses and say, I got this lovely email. On the other hand, a Gorham Brigham type handwritten note on good quality stationery, they'll remember that. Again, it's about product differentiation. Again, the other issue, as people get into their mobile devices and get into their own little worlds and just focus on themselves, someone like that is truly saying, I want to understand you. I want to understand, how can I help you? That is truly special. One of the things, for those of you who knew Gorham Brigham, correct me if I'm wrong, when he said, how can I help you, he really meant that. He wasn't saying, how can you help me? No, he was saying, how can I help you? And he really meant it. Do you know how rare that is? Tell me, when was the last time somebody sincerely went to you and said, how can I help you? And meant it.
Never the quid pro quo, follow on, ask.
No, never.
It was genuinely given.
I mean, this, again, if just stand back and just say, this is marketing 101. This is product differentiation.
Larry, can you talk a little bit about the demand we're seeing these days for CFOs and high-level finance execs who have better soft skills, better people skills, et cetera, and how that relates to what millennials expect in their interactions at work?
You know, one of the things, at least, one of the things that I am seeing is increasingly millennials are used to working in teams, and they expect their CFOs to be working in teams and not having a silo mentality. I think one of the worst things that I see CFOs doing is acting as CFOs. And one of the things we do in working with CFOs is teach them how to talk about wearing different hats. When if I put on my CFO hat, this is what I would have to say. On the other hand, if I put my strategy hat, this is what I would have to say. I think CEOs want to hear that. A key challenge for CFOs is how do you make the transition from being perceived as the head of a function to being a valued advisor to the CEO. And just being good in finance doesn't make you a valued advisor to the CEO. You got to be doing something else. You got to be showing you're actually looking at both sides of the basic accounting balance sheet. And the stereotype of the CFO is that's somebody who's living on the liability side of the basic accounting balance sheet and thinking that's good enough. It isn't. Never was.
Yep. Just a comment to buttress what you said about millennials and them looking for CFOs that aren't really into the balance sheet or the P&L. This is quarter end I'm doing, and I'm interim controller for a company. It's quarter end, and we're all sitting together looking at how to get the books closed. There's this young kid, recent graduate, and he just blurted out he needs to find out what to buy his girlfriend for the 6 months anniversary. Remember what we were doing? Closing the books, analyzing the balance sheet and the P&L. He's only interested in what to get for his girlfriend. She's a vegan, he said. And I said, dear car out to a bowling alley. He turned around and asked me if I was really listening. I said, yes, I have children your age. I'm older than you, so I am listening. He kept his mouth shut and went back to work. So, go figure. Girlfriend and closing the books. Doing what you were supposed to.
Any other questions? Again, if you'd like a copy of this podcast, just give me your business cards. If you'd like a copy of the Psychology Today article on Gorham, just give me your business cards. I'm glad to give it to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next month in November, we have a session, I forget the title of it on their website, but it's